Always claiming you the best proven. Got some things to explain, we ain't that stupid. Got the type of flow, you attest to it. Catch wreck, nothing less, we ain't about losing. And them lanes catch clean like a lot of fluid. Last chance in advance, you a light shooter. Last chance in advance, and we, you a flash in advance, and we about do it.
Everybody to the F-Ball NFL podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Hengst. I cover the National Football League for Bleacher Report, Scout.com, and now Sports on Earth.
Nice.
I'm joined by my co-host, Brian.
Hello.
We are back. We officially came back last week after our little two-month hiatus here, and not a moment too soon because stuff's starting to happen around the NFL.
Thank God.
And we'll talk about some of that here in just a few moments. We're also going to start previewing the divisions in anticipation of the start of the 2015 NFL season. We're going to start where it's easiest for us right now, and that would be, of course, the AFC North, one of my particular specialties in talking about and writing about the NFL. We're going to try to make sure that we get through all 8 divisions before the regular season starts. I'm not going to make any promises, but I'm going to say we're going to try.
And we'll probably try to see if we can get some guests on that are maybe a little more versed in what's going on in some of the other divisions.
Exactly. So in the coming weeks, look forward to that.
Schedule TBD, obviously.
Schedule to be determined. So before we talk about the AFC North, though, let's talk about some news around the league, mainly some contract situations getting resolved in the 11th hour. We have two franchise-tagged wide receivers, Demaryius Thomas of the Denver Broncos and, of course, Dez Bryant of the Dallas Cowboys, neither of whom were very happy about receiving the franchise tag this year. Demaryius Thomas has been staying away from OTAs and minicamp in protest of being given the tag and not a long-term deal, while Dez Bryant tweeted just a few days ago that he would, in fact, miss all of training camp and would miss regular season games if he wasn't given a new contract. But all of that conflict has been resolved. Demaryius Thomas and Dez Bryant both getting contracts today. Both contracts, 5 years, $70 million in total value. Slight differences for each, though, with Dez Bryant ending up with $45 million guaranteed, Demaryius Thomas with $43.5 million guaranteed, $35 million of that fully guaranteed upon signing. For Dez Bryant, meanwhile, $23 million will be fully guaranteed, and then he'll have another $20 million in signing bonus, and then a $3 million salary and $22 million in fully guaranteed bonus that comes into play next March. In other words, both of these young men just got paid handsomely.
Mm-hmm.
As they should. They're both vital components of their respective teams' offenses.
And among the best of their position in the league.
But they do set a new bar when you're talking about wide receiver contract negotiations, and that's something that the Atlanta Falcons and the Cincinnati Bengals will have to tackle down the line with Julio Jones and A.J. Green. A.J. Green said, he has said multiple times that he's not really concerned about not having that contract extension done already, that he would like it done sooner than later, but if it happens at the end of the 2015 season, he's fine with that as long as he gets that contract. All signs do seem to point towards Green getting that deal, but what that means for the rest of the Bengals roster in particular, with so many free agents set to hit the market next year, that's going to be interesting because they might have around $27 million in salary cap space, but the Bengals don't really like to spend a lot.
True.
And so while they might, be interested in locking up Green, that might not mean good things for a lot of these other free agents. Meanwhile, Julio Jones, he does seem destined to get another contract with the Falcons. Again, it's a matter, I think, of when and not if. Clearly, they know how much money they're going to have to set aside now that you look at these deals for Thomas and Bryant. But you got to wait and see, especially a guy like Julio Jones. And A.J. Green, too, has had a couple of injuries, had some foot problems and stuff. But Julio Jones has had, even more extensive injury history. And so taking that wait-and-see approach and seeing how he plays out his 2015 season before determining what his actual monetary value is makes sense.
Sure.
But it looks like it sets a new bar for negotiations, that's for sure. And these deals are only going to get more interesting because the salary cap is just going to keep going up and up and up and up to the point where something like this 5-year, $70 million, $45 million guaranteed deal that Dez Bryant got is going to become more routine and is not going to be as much big money as it seems relative to the salary cap.
Right. And I think that's the important thing whenever looking at any of these numbers is because they spend what they can spend, basically. I think most teams do.
Most teams get fairly close to the salary cap, but they don't want to be too close to it.
Right.
I mean, I think most teams would like to have about $7 or $8 million in carryover year by year.
But my point is, as it goes up, the amount that they can and are willing to spend goes up with it. So
you
shouldn't just necessarily look at raw numbers here and say, you know, and freak out basically because you just need to understand how it fits within the context of the cap.
Exactly. How it fits in with the context of the cap. And, of course, you can't even look at a 5-year, $70 million deal and say, yeah, Dez Bryant's going to play for the Cowboys for the next 5 years, and he's going to earn every penny of that $70 million, because that's not going to happen either. You have to look at the guaranteed money, and then you have to look at the fully guaranteed money and how that breaks down year by year to determine, okay, so this is a 2-year deal or this is a 3-year deal. So, you know, that's always the smart way to look at a contract, because otherwise you have everybody going, Andy Dalton got $96 million in 6 years, when that's you know, that's not the case. And that's the example I always like to bring up when I talk about
because
contracts.
Everybody flipped when that happens.
Because everybody flipped when that happens, and that's not what the deal really is at all. The other interesting thing about these two receiver deals, though, is that the NFLPA has accused the Broncos and the Cowboys of collusion. Of discussing amongst themselves the values of these respective contracts so that nobody overpays and everybody's kind of in the same situation, same boat. Jerry Jones, of course, denies this, that the Demaryius Thomas didn't influence what they decided to do with Dez Bryant. But I will say it is fascinating that they both ended up with 5-year, $70 million deals. I mean, the money's structured a little different for both of them.
It's partly that.
But that's interesting.
It's partly that, and partly the fact that the news of the deals being reached came out, like, within minutes of each other.
Yeah, within about 10 minutes of each other.
Yeah,
sure,
so it's like they basically got the same numbers. Again, there's differences in there, sure. But it's overall, it's almost the same deal, and it was announced 10 minutes apart. So
yeah, but no collusion, guys.
No, none of that.
There's
none
been no collusion here. It's just a coincidence because
pay no attention
because
to that.
The deadline has, you know, it's the deadline. That's all. It's just the nature of the deadline. Thomas and Bryant, though, aren't the only players to get paid. Patriots kicker Steven Gostkowski, he was also given the franchise tag. He has come to terms with the Patriots on a 4-year $17.2 million deal, making him the highest paid kicker in the league. Over the last 2 years, he has had field goal make percentages of 92.7% and 94.6%, which is very impressive, among the best, if not the best, in the league. And I think in the last 2 years, he's only missed one field goal of over 50 yards.
Yeah, he's good.
He's good. And
he should be the highest paid kicker.
He should be the highest paid kicker. So that means that only Jason Pierre-Paul remains among players that have been given the franchise tag this year. Of course, we know what happened with Pierre-Paul and the fireworks. He's not going to sign the franchise tag until he's healthy. That's within his right. He has until sometime it's like November 7th or November 17th or whatever to sign it, or else he can't play. He'll be healed from his injury, the fireworks and the surgery and all of that, well before then. So it's just that's also a matter of time. But then we'll also have to see what happens because, you know, he's kind of not in a good mood with the Giants right now. He wants a long-term contract. This fireworks thing has kind of made it so that that's not going to happen. So he's going to have to sign that franchise tag.
Yeah.
At some point, whenever he's healthy. So they get it in by the deadlines for three of the four players given the franchise tag. So that's good. Just good to get those out of the way, especially because everybody's kind of been wringing their hands about Dez Bryant after him tweeting about missing games and stuff. And people, mm-hmm. You got Cowboys fans freaking out. You've got fantasy football people freaking out. So
yeah,
it's all taken care of now. We don't have to worry about it. There's also the key dates for the 2015-2016.
Well, there was one more contract. The Justin Houston got announced.
Oh, that's right. Justin Houston. He also got crazy money.
Yeah, he got good money.
He got good money.
Which he should.
He got good money.
He
got,
what, 22 sacks last year?
Six years, $101 million, $52.5 million of that guaranteed.
Yeah, that's
wild.
That's a nice haul.
He's earned it. He's earned it.
Yeah.
You know,
he's a lot
of people tweet now, what, like, sacks equals stacks?
Sacks equals stacks,
but
yeah.
But it's true. In the NFL, you know, that's you know, one of the more gaudy stats a defensive player can have, especially a guy in the front seven. So, and Justin Houston, he produces year after year. He consistently can get to the quarterback. So
it's funny to me, too, because, like, I think sacks are they're fun to watch. I think it obviously recognizes when a player is good.
Sure.
And it's an important thing.
Because it means they have speed, athleticism, and leverage.
But I'm saying specifically within the game, it's important. I think it's more important for the players and their individual accomplishments than it is within any given game. One sack. And you could have a sack in every game. You have 16 sacks. It's a great season. But those individual sacks within those individual games don't necessarily – it's just one play. It doesn't necessarily
do a
lot. Yeah,
but that could be a play that kills a drive.
I'm not saying they're not important. I kind of feel like they're overblown in importance. You know what I mean? Because it's just
sure.
Like everybody talks about how, you know, having the pass rusher and getting the sacks is like the most important thing and all this stuff.
Right.
And it's just like – but yeah, but if you get 10 sacks a game because you got a bunch of guys that can do it, you know, obviously you're going to have a menacing defense and it's going
to
be
10 sacks in a game would be
but
I don't even
saying,
know what to say
but
about
that's what
that.
I'm saying.
Would be so crazy.
I'm just thinking, like, you know, we're still only talking about a limited number of downs, and like you get sacked, you lose 8 yards, maybe you have an and 12 instead of an and 2 or whatever the situation may be. It makes things harder for sure, but it's still just one play. You know what I mean?
Right, but there are other things that you – if you can be the league's top pass rusher in terms of sack totals, that means that the plays where you're not getting sacks, you are disrupting the quarterback.
True.
You're pressuring him, you're hurrying him,
absolutely.
You're hitting him.
And the
key is disruption of the quarterback and – when
I think a
you
lot of good
sacks,
defenses are built on that, too,
right.
From getting to the pressure that causes a lot of other things to happen.
Right,
for
and
the
if
defenses.
You see a player
sure.
or a defense that has a high sack total, of course they're going to have a ton of hits, a ton of hurries, too. And so, you know, it's about disrupting
good point.
The quarterback.
That's another good point, though, is that there could be situations where guys are good at getting pressure on the quarterback, but they don't get the sacks for whatever reason.
A good example of that is James Harrison last year. James Harrison didn't
okay.
have a huge sack total. I mean, and people can say, oh, yeah, but he's old. You know, he's 36. But he's a different kind of 36 than most 36-year-old football players.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have a high sack total last year at all, but he had a ton of hits and hurries, a ton of hurries. And that, you know – just disrupting a quarterback in that way can...
So that's my point, is that we focus on sacks as the key stat here, when potentially it's...
Pressures
that
right.
include sacks and hurries and...
Right.
Just getting your hands on them, but you didn't quite go down or whatever. Like, maybe that's how we should measure the... I mean, especially when you're talking about it's resulting in, you know, $100 million, 52 guaranteed or whatever...
Sure.
...for a guy who is obviously very good at this, you know what I mean? But that's what I'm saying is, like, the sack itself seems like it's slightly overvalued.
Right. But I think the sack is like where there's smoke, there's fire. So you're getting a lot of sacks. There's a lot of other disruption
True.
You're doing.
Yeah,
you have it's almost necessary.
I'm not necessarily saying that. It's mainly that just to look at the sack rather than to look at the other things that what the sack represents, which is the pressure, you know, and getting to the quarterback, getting in the quarterback's face and all that.
Sure.
And that's what the defenses want. Sacks, obviously, you want because it's a negative play.
It's a negative play, yeah. Any play you can get something for a loss, do it, right?
Right.
You take that all day long.
It's not a strong point I have here, but I think I got a little one.
I see what you're trying to say, but
it's hard to argue.
It's hard. Yes.
Definitely true.
Yeah. And the NFL key dates for the 2015-2016 season were released today on Wednesday. Just of note, the 2016 NFL draft will be held from April 28th to 30th. Obviously, a site to be determined. It was in Chicago in 2015. Chances are it's going to be in Los Angeles or somewhere else and not New York City next year. But just so you know.
So it's basically the same, though. It's the last Thursday, Friday, Saturday of April.
Of April, yeah. All right, well, we are going to take a quick break here at the F-Ball NFL podcast, and we're going to come back and do a little preview of the AFC North, what we could expect to see from the Steelers, Bengals, Ravens, and Browns in 2015. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
All right.
Metaphor is the shit that they begging for. Make them look like the seven dwarfs. Set it off and reset the score. If you ever expected anything less than the best, then boy, my repertoire is the war with these dogs in the reservoir. My ego is Tarantino, go Guido like in casino. Unbeatable while they follow my lead and feed me amigo. Whole fam sit at the table, no need in being greedy. God done bless me like I'm sneezing. Need a reason, a fan of the challenge. While your plans are standing the balance, damn it, I'm causing damage to the band on a couple.
We're gonna kick off our divisional previews with the AFC North. Of course, the Pittsburgh Steelers, Cincinnati Bengals, Baltimore Ravens, and Cleveland Browns making up the four teams in that AFC North division. So where should we start? Do you want to start, Brian? Do you want to start with the division winners or the division last placers? Where should we start? From the top down or the bottom up?
I like to go inside out, but let's start at the top.
All right, we'll start at the top. That would be, of course, the Pittsburgh Steelers winning their division with an 11-5 record last year, and then missing out in the playoffs in the wild card round to the rival Baltimore Ravens. Thanks mostly, I will say, mostly in part to the fact that Le'Veon Bell couldn't play. He suffered that knee injury in week 16. That's something to keep in mind for the Steelers this year because Le'Veon Bell, unless things change, because of course we haven't heard anything yet, Le'Veon Bell will be suspended for the first three games of the season. Now, the Steelers are in better shape than they were last year when they lost Bell for the playoffs because they saw this coming for some time now. They can prepare for a three-game stretch without Le'Veon Bell, and they brought in D'Angelo Williams, who will be his backup for the rest of the season, but should be capable enough, given his history in the NFL, to be able to take on that starting role in the first three games, and he'll be prepared as compared to them signing Ben Tate off of the street last year and pairing him up with Josh Harris.
Right.
But that is going to be a difficult thing for them to overcome because Le'Veon Bell, on top of the fact that he was the team's leading rusher last year, had something like 800 receiving yards and over 700 yards after the catch. And with the Steelers' offense kind of relying so heavily on the yards after the catch, you miss that weapon in him.
Sure.
And someone's going to have to pick up that slack for three games. And it's not that the Steelers don't have the players who can, because there's still Antonio Brown. There's Marcus Wheaton. There's Martavis Bryant, who broke out last year. There's Heath Miller. There's whatever D'Angelo Williams brings to the table. There's whatever Dre Archer brings to the table. So there are options there, but they're going to miss that. And that's a big problem because the Steelers, based on strength of schedule, have the toughest schedule based on last year's results.
Yeah, well, he's only out for three games at the most. I mean,
and it's not the hardest three-game stretch that they're facing all of the season. I mean, they open against the New England Patriots. They might not have Tom Brady. And then I think their next two games.
Yeah, that one's just hard to call regardless.
Yeah, and I think their next two games are at least against manageable opponents, if I recall correctly. So it's not like they're when they have to go to Seattle to face the Seahawks, which they have to do this year, they're, that's not going to be Durek Bell's suspension.
Sure, sure. So they might be able to stem the tide and deal with his absence for however long that ends up being, if it's the full three games or something less. And then they get him back and – Yeah, I think that offense is they shouldn't really do much except what they were doing.
Yes, what they did last year. What they did last year was they were the second most productive offense in the league, right behind the New Orleans Saints. Ben Roethlisberger had the best year of his career. He tied his touchdown passes, his career high in touchdown passes with 32. He had his most yards he's ever thrown. Didn't take a lot of sacks. Really relied on that quick passing and the yards after the catch, and that'll continue. The real question, and it was a problem for the Steelers last year, and now it's a question mark, and it's that defense. Because now, you know, you don't have Troy Polamalu, he's retired. You don't have Ike Taylor, he's retired. Brett Kiesel has retired. And these guys, you know, they were, especially when you talk about Ike Taylor and Polamalu, were kind of past their prime and sometimes were even on-field liabilities for the Steelers. But when you look at the players tasked with replacing them, you know, Cortez Allen, the cornerback, he has to come back and rebuild his fundamentals and his confidence in order to regain his starting job. You've got William Gay. He's pretty solid. Antoine Blake broke out last year, but then you've got rookies. You've got Senquist Golson. You've got Doran Grant. You've guys you haven't seen before. You've got Kevin Fogg. On top of that, so you don't have Polamalu. Replacing him is Shamarco Thomas, whom the Steelers drafted a couple years back in round 4. He only played 2 defensive snaps last year, and he's had a lot of little lingering injury problems over the last 2 years. And so putting him in that position of starting in place of Polamalu, will he be able to physically hold up? And what does he even look like out there in run support and coverage and blitzes? Because we don't know.
Right.
And then you have Mike Mitchell, the other safety, and he came on to the team last year after spending time with the Carolina Panthers, and he was definitely not as good for the Steelers as he was in Carolina, but he also was playing with 2 torn groin muscles that he's since had surgically repaired. So you'd assume that a second year in a pretty much the same defense, I mean, Dick LeBeau's gone, but Keith Butler got promoted, in a similar, the same defense, and he's healthy, you'd think he'd step up, but again, we don't know. We don't know who the real Mike Mitchell is. We don't know who the real Shamarco Thomas is. We don't know who even the real Cortez Allen is. And this is just the secondary.
I do want to – you kind of gloss over it because you say Keith Butler was around and LeBeau.
He was around longer than LeBeau.
I know. I'm not – but I'm just saying that, you know, LeBeau had established success, you know.
Sure.
And it was consistent. And they – you know, he had a thing and it worked for a long time.
Right.
And it worked better
until
it worked better than others, and at times, sure. But I'm just saying that, like, I don't necessarily think it's going to be a downgrade with Keith Butler, but I think potentially there could be. It's just another unknown, and I think that's
sure.
The biggest thing about the Steelers' defense this year is that there's so many unknowns with, like you said, the new faces in the backfield, the new faces wherever.
We'll talk about the front 7 in a second.
All over the place, yeah.
But the one thing I do want to add about Keith Butler, because defensive end Cameron Hayward, he was asked about this by MMQB's Robert Klemko last month, and he said that fundamentally it's pretty much the same, but there are going to be some little pass rushing techniques. There's not going to be any double teams. Everybody's going to have a man-on-man assignment. The whole goal this year is to get to the quarterback. The Steelers only had, 33 sacks last year. It was not very good. So that's going to change. He said that there's a few differences to some of the blitzes, but for the most part, it's a little bit more aggressive. Keith Butler himself is more aggressive. He screams. Mm-hmm. Dick LeBeau doesn't scream at you.
This is my.
So there are going to be some tweaks, but it's not. It's not like bringing in a whole new guy.
Absolutely not. My main point in this is that even if you have somebody taking over that is basically running the same scheme, I'm not necessarily talking about scheme as much as there's other things involved, such as in-game adjustments and things like that. That you know, just because Butler has never done this at the DC level before.
Sure.
You don't necessarily know that it's – I mean, he might end up, you know, having a better defense than LeBeau has over the last couple of years because maybe, you know, maybe certain things are passing LeBeau by. I don't know. But I'm just saying those are all potentials out there. It's just another unknown that we don't exactly – you know, you can't just assume that part of it is going to be the same just because
sure.
It's the similar scheme or whatever, you know.
Right. And then the front 7, there are also question marks there. They drafted Bud Dupree in round 1 to boost their pass rush. He's already been doing some work with the first team in OTAs and minicamp, so that's a really good sign.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got him, you've got James Harrison, you've got Arthur Motes, and you've got Jarvis Jones. And Jarvis Jones missed a lot of time last year with a wrist injury. He said in late May that it's still not 100% yet, and when you got to jam people – and you're coming off a broken wrist, I can understand why Jarvis Jones is his wrist is still not 100%. So I don't know how – we don't know how that's going to play out. Obviously, all four of those guys are going to see the field on a regular basis. But who starts? What's the situational usage of them? That's something we don't know yet. And then, you know, and really the and then when you talk about the inside linebackers, you know, Lawrence Timmons obviously has been a fixture there, and that's not a problem. But then it looks like this is going to be the – Ryan Shazier's big chance to regain that starting job again. And, you know, we didn't see a lot of him last year. He started the first five games, looked pretty good, got injured, and then came back and was part of a three-man rotation. Right. And then you've got the defensive line because Steve McClendon, the nose tackle, says that he's healthy now. He had off-season shoulder surgery. But then, you know, when are they going to rotate in Daniel McCullers? Because McCullers has kind of had a nice off-season. You've got Cameron Hayward at defensive end. That's not a problem. Stephon Tuitt, in his second year, is probably going to be the starting defensive end there, but we didn't see a ton of him last year. He did become a starter by the end of the year. So there's just a lot of question marks on that defense. Mm-hmm. The offense is set. The only problem for the offense is just those three games to start the year without Bell. But on defense, who knows? I mean, I'm looking forward to training camp in the preseason just to kind of get an idea of what players are going to do what on that defense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's they're intriguing from that standpoint that there's the offense is a known commodity and it's good. And, you know, assuming they don't get in their own way knock on wood, have any, you know, major injuries or anything like that, you expect them to be right back up there and be, you know, everything that they've come to be over the last couple of years. And kind of pick up where they left off.
Yeah,
there's so many variables.
There's so many different things in the defense, and the Steelers have such a difficult schedule.
Right.
That it's gonna be interesting to watch. I'm not gonna really have any idea about the Steelers team until I actually see them on the field. Moving on.
No predictions.
Cincinnati Bengals.
We're not doing predictions, right?
No.
Yeah, good.
Cincinnati Bengals went 10-5-1 last year, second place in the division, and returned to the playoffs only, of course, to go 1-done. Of course. But this is a team that, you know, despite that problem, which is partially a quarterback Andy Dalton problem, aside from that problem, the Bengals don't have that many problems, except they need to rush the passer. After a couple of years after being one of the best pass rushing units in the league, they had, what, 20, 21 sacks last year?
Yeah, it was something terrible.
It was terrible. It was, like, worst in the league. You know, they really felt that loss of Michael Johnson. He's back now after 1 year with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They really felt the fact that Geno Atkins, you know, took him – he wasn't really 100% back from his injury last year. He is now. So, you know, the hope there
– getting the gang back together.
They get the gang back together. They get everybody healthy. They have that, you know, rotational defensive front that has pass rushing specialists who can get to the quarterback. Mm-hmm. That's something they really need to focus on this year. You know, and because it's going to get difficult for the Bengals. I mean, they have a tough schedule, of course, this year. But then they have, you know, as we were talking about earlier when we were talking about the A.J. Green contract situation, they've got a lot of unrestricted free agents. Both of their starting offensive tackles, Mohamed Sanu, Marvin Jones, Wallace Gilberry, the list goes on. And they're not going to, even if they could pay all those guys, they're not going to, because that would leave them with, like, no cap room. And that's not a Mike Brown thing.
No, and honestly, I wouldn't expect them to. They should plan on guys leaving because they don't.
Sure.
They can't really pay them.
And the Bengals have,
because they built all this, or say they don't do a lot in free agency. This is all built through the draft and Mike Brown.
Most of this is built through the draft. Things like the cornerback position, a lot of those veterans there are acquisitions from other areas, like Adam Jones and Leon Hall.
Yeah, there was a couple guys here and there. But for the most part, the core of that defense was built through the draft.
The core of that team was built through the draft.
Right, so that's why I don't see that changing. And so they'll let some of these guys go and hope they keep replenishing through the draft.
Right, and that's the thing, because they got, you know, the Bengals drafted two offensive tackles in rounds 1 and 2 last year, or this year in the draft. So they're going to be, you know, as long as those guys do their jobs and seem to be as good as their draft stock said that they are, then the Bengals should be fine. If they let Andre Smith and Andrew Whitworth leave
right.
their tackles next year.
Right, exactly.
I'm just curious to see what ends up unfolding when it comes to the Andy Dalton situation, because the thing is that after this year, the Bengals can start doing that opt out clause in the contract where they can ditch mm-hmm. Dalton for
right,
little to
right,
no cap
yeah.
hit, same as Colin Kaepernick. So I'm curious to see what kind of a leash they have on him this year, and what happens if the Bengals reach the playoffs and go one and done again, and Andy Dalton doesn't throw any touchdowns, he throws two interceptions, because the powers that be in Cincinnati, which is not just Mike Brown, there are a few others, really love AJ McCarron a lot, and that's Andy Dalton's backup. So I would not be surprised if they truly believe that, you know, sometime this year or after this season, if Dalton's really reached his ceiling and this is it, I wouldn't be surprised. Especially because look at all the money it would save them. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
Because Dalton's deal,
he's
you know, he gets more expensive
money.
Next year. He costs something like $13 million or $17 million or something next year. AJ McCarron costs pennies.
Right.
Pennies, comparatively. And if they do want to re-sign an inordinate number of these free agents, why not dump that Dalton deal and free up another $10
million? Sure. No, that makes – I mean, I think that's probably the biggest storyline of this year's Bengals. They're still kind of who they were over the last couple of years. They're very balanced. They got a lot of talent. They can certainly make some noise and do some things, but a lot of this is comes down to, you know, what is Dalton going to be able to turn the corner? Is he going to continue to have these clunkers in night games? Is he going to continue to, you know, help lead the team to the playoffs and then have
lead them right out the door of it.
Lead them right out the door, exactly. And I think if he really appears to regress at all, I think that that's probably a no-brainer.
Sure.
And if he can get them to that playoff win, I would assume that that's kind of a no-brainer to keep him at
sure.
that point, because he has shown a lot of progress. Albeit in small increments.
Progress, but he gets better at completion percentage. He gets better at yards. He gets a little better every year. That is true.
And I think earlier in his career, it felt like, you know, he was kind of holding them back. And I think over the last couple years, it's been in the certain games where he's really laid duds out there, he's held them back. But for the rest of the time, he's actually done a pretty good job of commandeering the offense. And
last year, he was far less erratic than he was in the previous years. I mean, very much so. There were times where I watched him and I just thought, wow, like, Dalton's turned a corner. But he hasn't completely turned that corner yet. It's just he's getting close. But seriously,
that's going to be the hardest thing, though, is what if it is almost exactly the same, where
then that's when you have to determine if he's hit his ceiling and he can go no further. And then what do you do there? Do you stay with a mediocre quarterback, or do you roll the dice on McCarron, who they acclaim to love?
Right.
And the other thing, too, worth noting is I forget which Bengals player this was, but it was last month. And they're saying that there's a real sense of urgency, a greater sense of urgency than any time in the past couple of years in that locker room, because everybody can kind of sense that this playoff window that's been open for them for so long is slowly starting to close, and things are going to change.
There's going to be
on that roster over this year, over the next 2 years, over 2016 and 2017. You got a lot of important guys hitting free agency. You got a lot of guys hitting the age of 30. So, you know, they're running out of time. And if if they think Dalton is making them lose even more time, they got to turn from him. So it's a big year for Andy Dalton. He has to prove it. He has to prove to the Bengals he's worth the money that they would pay him if they keep him around. And the other thing I'm also keeping an eye on in Cincinnati is linebacker Vontaze Burfict, because he underwent microfracture surgery. It was a very complicated process create little micro fractures in the knee in order to try to spur growth of cartilage. And it's a very risky procedure. It's one that's never 100% guaranteed to be successful. And he's making slow progress. But the comments that Marvin Lewis, the Bengals head coach, has made seems like it's a very cautious, guarded, slow, no guarantees that he's going to be able to go. So that's just something to keep an eye on, because the Bengals defense as a whole is always better when Vontaze Burfict is out there. Mm-hmm. He's their leading tackler. He's been the NFL's leading tackler. You know, he stops the run. He works in pass rush support. He works sometimes in coverage and all of that. So I'm curious to see, you know, if he's going to be able to get back on the field for week one or at all this year. So,
right.
You know, that's a big one. I mean, you think about an interior linebacker on like a 4-3 team, or outside linebacker on 4-3 team, not really being that important, but, you know, to the overall defense. But Burfict really is, and you can see the difference when he's there and he's not there. So I'm curious about that. I'm curious about, you know, the band getting back together, so to speak, when it comes to that pass rushing crew with the Atkins and the others. And
yeah, that should be interesting.
Johnson. All right, moving on to the Baltimore Ravens. The Baltimore Ravens also made it to the playoffs last year. That's 3 out of the 4 teams. Not bad, AFC North. They had a 10-6 record. The main thing for the Baltimore Ravens is getting that secondary healthy. You know, their secondary, especially their cornerbacks, were just getting destroyed last year. And that's just because so many of their starters were injured. They were down to the dregs of their defensive backs roster. So that should improve this year, just because you're going to have your starters out there.
Right.
That's not something I'm really worried about with them. What I am kind of worried about, though, is Joe Flacco, because he's got he's a little bit like Andy Dalton, you know, in that it's kind of inconsistent start, slow start to his career, making incremental improvements. Of course, had that fabulous offseason that led to the Super Bowl victory that led to his giant payday. Mm-hmm. But what I'm curious about, you know, he's heading into his fourth year with this fourth new offensive coordinator. Of course, we've got Mark Trestman there now, because Gary Kubiak's out in Denver. And Trestman has a similar offense to what Kubiak ran, so that shouldn't be a big problem.
In some ways, yeah.
And we've seen Joe Flacco transition through four different coordinators and not really look all that different. The problem is he's transferred between four different coordinators and not really looked all that different. And Kubiak and Trestman's systems are both very quarterback friendly. You know, you do have some deep bombs that take advantage, of course, of Flacco's big arm. And then you do a lot of things that, again, rely on yards after the catch, a lot of high percentage throws. And he's shown a little bit of inaccuracy on these throws that should be, you know, very useful, very good for him in a quarterback friendly offense. You know, I think Flacco is a good quarterback. I think he's a very good quarterback. I think I've seen him play very well, and he's come a long way. But I'm just curious to see what happens now that he doesn't have Torrey Smith. He has Breshad Perriman instead. You know, we're still waiting to see on Dennis Pitta, the tight end, and whether he can come back after suffering two back-to-back hip fractures. Of course, they drafted Max Williams, and they have what is that tight end's name?
Crockett Gilmore.
Who they love. They love Crockett Gilmore, so I'm not super worried about the Pitta thing. But the thing is, though, is that Pitta was a guy that Flacco had a lot of chemistry with on field, and is one of his best friends.
Sure.
And then you have Torrey Smith. While, you know, Torrey Smith's not catching not even 50% of the passes that have been thrown to him, you know, what he provides stretching the field, taking defensive resources with him wherever he goes, those pass interference specials,
yeah,
man.
I was going to say the PI special.
Leading the league for years. The Ravens have been with the Torrey Smith Joe Flacco connection. I'm curious to see what does that mean for Joe Flacco. One thing that's going to help, though, Justin Forsett is still there as their feature back, and you know, he caught quite a few passes last year, but he's going to catch like 130 or 100, or at least be targeted like 130 times in Trestman's offense. Because if you look at the passing, the targets and the receptions and the receiving yards that Matt Forte had under Trestman
with
the Chicago Bears.
No, that's definitely a big part of Trestman's offense.
So,
sure.
That's a huge part of Trestman's offense. So that should make things so much easier for Flacco, because if you think back to you know, the heyday of when Ray Rice was playing really well back in the day, Ray Rice would routinely have 700 or 800 receiving yards in a year and was one of Flacco's, you know, most trusted and reliable targets.
Right.
So if he can get that 700 or 800 passing yards from Justin – receiving yards, I guess, in Forsett's case, out of Justin Forsett, then that takes a lot of pressure off of Flacco, kind of, you know, where's Max Williams? Where's this stupid rookie? Why are you not running your route? I'm getting sacked. So, you know what I mean? You can just, like, catch and run, Justin, catch and run. So that should make things easier for him.
No, I think that's a good point. I think that there was obviously some – I mean, Steve Smith's still around, right?
Yeah, Steve Smith's still there. Oh, yeah.
So he's ageless and –
Sure.
He's
a tough man.
He turned out to be their best receiver last year, which wasn't real surprising to me.
By the second half of the season, though, he kind of...
Well, he's older.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, just, I think getting the kid and Perriman, whether or not Pitt is back, they have the younger tight ends that they can go to. They're probably going to be passing to Forsett more, like you mentioned. I think a lot of that will help at least the passing part of the offense. I'd say... I'm expecting it to be better than it was last year.
Sure.
No, sheer numbers-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe Perriman, there's a lot of similarities. At least that's what I had heard. I don't know too much about him.
There's
a lot of similarities with him and Torrey Smith.
With him and Torrey Smith.
But potentially he'll
catch more of those
targets. Maybe catch more, yeah. And it won't just be a PI special type guy.
Sure.
But even if he is, that is all he is, I think that Flacco can probably, like, coach him up to be the next Torrey Smith.
The other thing too is, like, you know, aside from Steve Smith, I mean, a lot of the Ravens receivers are either young or untested, and so I think that's going to be interesting to see what happens there, because obviously Steve Smith's not going to be there forever. I mean, this might be it for him right now.
Sure.
You know, after this season, so we got to get these young guys, got to get those young guys going. Moving to the front seven, the Ravens were unable to retain pass rushing specialist Pernell McPhee. He is now with the Chicago Bears. So I'm curious to see exactly what that's going to do to affect their pass rush. Of course, you know, they still have Terrell Suggs, and they've got Elvis Dumervil,
They traded Nada, too, to the Lions.
And they lost Filoti Nada, trading him to the Lions. So
there's going to be some differences there.
There's
for
going
sure.
to be some differences.
But
there.
I don't expect much, like I would say, much difference in the on-field, you know, product. Because I don't know. That's just one of those things. It's like, oh, the Ravens front seven. It really doesn't matter what year it is or who the people are, the coaches or the players. They're just kind of always good.
That's true, and I mean they've just got a lot of good young players to go along mm-hmm. with Dumervil and Suggs. You know, they've got Daryl Smith there, and they've got
Mosley.
Mosley, who had an excellent rookie season,
ridiculous last year, yeah. And I mean he looks like he could be in the future, maybe in another year or two, like just the focal point of that defense for years.
Absolutely. So I mean, it's not like all hope is lost there, but it is going to be kind of interesting. Just because, you know, Filoti Nada has such a reputation in the NFL that it's scary to be lined up against him. Even if you're an offensive lineman who can manhandle Filoti Nada,
right.
It's still like you're looking across and it's freaking Filoti Nada. You
right.
know what I mean? And so you lose some of that intimidation. You know, the same thing with the Steelers and Troy Polamalu. Polamalu might not be the player he used to be, but you still got to consider him.
You know? You see
and
that curly hair sticking out of his helmet.
You got to keep an eye on
him. Yeah, and it makes it sticks in everybody's head, like you said.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
So, you know, they lose some perceived fierceness by not having Filoti Nada. Whether or not they actually lose any fierceness is one thing, but the perception is still pretty powerful, you know?
Right, which is the mystique that comes along with a good player. Sometimes is pretty powerful. Sometimes it can be, especially when a player's older or maybe past his prime or something like that, sometimes the mystique is almost more effective than the actual player's play, you know?
Yeah, we can say, Polamalu, case in point.
Case in point, yeah.
And finally, the Cleveland Browns, The Cleveland Browns went 7-9 last year, and it could have been better than that if Brian Hoyer didn't have that late season meltdown that coincided with the return of Josh Gordon, who was suspended for the whole year, and of course the leg injury to center Alex Mack that had him sidelined for the second half of the year. 7-9 though, the Browns' best record since 2007 when they won 10 games.
Yeah.
So this was Mike Pettine's first year at head coach as head coach, and he dealt with a whole bunch of messy situations and still managed to get to that 7-win mark. So I think that's a success for him and for his team. But it might be a little tougher to get to that 7-win mark this year because, again, the AFC North in general is just playing such a brutal schedule.
Because they get the NFC West, right?
They get the NFC West and the AFC West.
And the AFC West, so.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely a tough schedule. But this Browns team is funny to me. Their defense looked more than solid last year. And
wait, no, it didn't.
No,
only
except for the run.
That's, the secondary and the pass rush.
There's such a conundrum because there's so many good things about the team, yet other things that are just like glaringly bad. You know, like.
Well, you can't have a pass rush if you can't stop the run. If you can't stop the run, you can't have a pass rush. So that just does it right there.
Right.
Their secondary is, in some ways, I think
somehow good despite having no pass rush.
The best in the league.
But that's the other thing too. Is like, how are they so good as a secondary when like there's teams and well-respected coaches that have the philosophy of you can't have a good secondary unless you have a good pass rush. Which again, it's all philosophies, you know what I mean? But
sure.
But still, you know, it lends one to think that if there is no pass rush, it's going to be really hard to have a good secondary. And yet, they had a really good secondary and had zero pass rush.
Well,
so,
they did better than the Bengals. I mean, they still had 31 sacks, or whatever. But
you know what I'm saying.
But the thing is, too, the other thing to consider about the Browns struggling to stop the run last year, they gave up 141.6 rushing yards per game on average, guys. Terrible. So many injuries. Phil Taylor on IR. Armani Bryant got hurt. Desmond Bryant got hurt. John Hughes got hurt. There are a lot of guys, key parts of that heavily rotational but still, you know, pretty stable defensive line.
Mm-hmm.
And when you just have so many guys injured and you have to plug and play people, you know, like Jamie Madier or something who are just like third string backups or rotational backups or special teams players, for God's sakes. You're not going to get a lot of good positive production.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys are all back and healthy now. And then the Browns also drafted Danny Shelton in round one, and he'll be switching around nose tackle with Phil Taylor, to be certain. And that's going to really help them stop the run because he's a massive dude.
Mm-hmm.
And he can stop the run, and he can take double teams and pass rushing situations. So it looks like the front seven should be in better shape. They also drafted outside linebacker Nate Orchard. They've got this guy, Scott Solomon, who they brought on late last year and who's made a very positive impression in OTAs and minicamp. He looks like he's going to get the early down work at edge rusher, and then Barkevious Mingo will get some later down stuff because their Browns defensive coordinator Jim O'Neill's like, you know, Mingo's our best linebacker in coverage regardless of what he has or hasn't done. And as a pass rusher. So you put all those rotational pieces together, and it looks like the Browns should have improvement in that front seven. Because, again, look, I mean, it's Jim O'Neill, and it's Mike Pettine. I mean, look at Mike Pettine's mm-hmm. resume. Look at the defense that he built in Buffalo. Look at the defenses he helped build and worked on in Baltimore
to get to the point where it's at least a solid, if not a very good defense.
Sure. And the secondary, you know, the only change the secondary has really seen is that Buster Skrine is gone. But they brought in Tremont Williams, who's an underrated cornerback for the Green Bay Packers for many years.
Uh-huh.
So he should be able to pick up where Skrine left off and do better because Buster Skrine had like 17 pass interference penalties or something last year, which is just like, really? Is that even possible? Is that even possible? But the real question marks for the Cleveland Browns, as it is every year, is the offense.
Yeah,
and
that's
the
where I was going with that earlier. Yeah, seriously, they have easily one of the more solid lines in the league. I would say
they have
from
a very good
from left to right
pass
tackle,
protecting
going all the way
offensive
across
line. Oh my God!
Obviously they lost Alex Mack last year, and they suffered from that.
They suffered for it, especially the run game really suffered. So at least they drafted Cam Irving. So, you know, Irving might play right guard, but if Matt gets hurt again, he can move to center.
He can move around. And
yeah, he can play every position on the line.
So, yeah.
Right.
So it's, you know, Alex Mack is back, right?
Yes.
So
he's back.
So you get that back. You got this young guy. He's adding depth and positional flexibility, and so there's depth on other positions and things. It's definitely an improved situation from what was already a good line, you know, save for that injury last year. And then you have those two running backs last year that both looked really good, and then they go get Duke Johnson.
Right, and Duke Johnson's going to be running. He's going to be catching passes. We have
he might
three-man.
Be the most versatile of the three.
Right, he's definitely the most versatile of the three. I mean, I think all three are going to see increased passing targets now that we've got John DeFilippo as offensive coordinator as compared to Kyle Shanahan last year. But clearly, of those three, Duke Johnson's going to be the one to get the most passing targets. I mean, he that's what he did in college.
Right,
you know, he ran, he caught, he's Miami's all-time leading rusher, which I think is just crazy to think about. This little kid, you know, and he only played two full seasons for them too, which is the other thing to be impressed with him.
Right.
But the real question comes on at quarterback.
I still think, and maybe you can talk me down off this.
Sure.
I still think that there's questions at receiver. I know that there's a little bit of what was the problem. Was it the Chiefs or was it Dwayne Bowe?
It's not Dwayne Bowe.
Right.
If you ask Dwayne Bowe, Dwayne Bowe was not the problem.
Obviously, Dwayne Bowe is going to think that it was the Chiefs the problem. I'm just saying, like, it's one of those things, and, you know, until I see him there and I see him doing some things and actually helping that offense be a little bit better from the receiver position.
Sure.
It's still somewhat of a question mark in my mind.
Well, he says he strives to be Josh Gordon. He wants to be what Josh Gordon was to the team 2 years ago. He wants to be that vertical deep threat. He wants to be the guy that he himself was 5 years ago. You know?
Yeah. And if he can get back there and then potentially that, I'll shut up about it certainly, but other than him, like, you know, with Gordon gone, you know, they Hartline is the other guy they brought in. Yeah, I've never been, you know, that's not much of a move to me.
Okay, let me talk you down from this. All right, things like Dwayne Bowe and Brian Hartline being there are kind of stop gaps for right now because there was really nothing the Browns could really do. They did draft a receiver. They took a receiver in round four, Vince Male. He should be able to go for training camp. He broke his thumb and had been in a cast the whole time. He's been just following Dwayne Bowe around everywhere, trying to learn everything he possibly can. He's taking mental reps at three positions when he's been at training camp or mini camp and OTAs. He sounds very prepared, sounds very confident. So we'll see what he looks like when he can get out there in training camp. There's Taylor Gabriel. He was their second leading receiver last year. He was undrafted, came out of nowhere. You've got Andrew Hawkins. He was their leading receiver last year. He'll probably move back into the slot now with Dwayne Bowe and Brian Hartline there. But he's going to see more opportunities out of the slot, especially because
I like Hawkins out of the slot better anyway.
It suits him as a catch-and-run kind of guy. It suits him a little bit better, but it's not going to be the same being used in the slot like he was when he was with the Bengals, where they barely used him because they just had too many guys. Like, the Browns love him, and they pursued him heavily last year on purpose. So then they have that. They obviously, of course, have Duke Johnson, who can catch passes.
Yeah.
They brought in tight end Rob Housler. All he does is catch passes. That's the kind of tight end he is. He's the Jordan Cameron replacement, but they still have Jim Dray. They still have Gary Barnage. They've got this. They got this young rookie, Darius Jennings. He kind of looks like Taylor Gabriel did last year. So they've got this little up and coming dude.
See, that's the thing is they have.
They have little guys, up and comers.
I'm going to say that they have
rando vets
potential from the receiving core.
There's
not
potential.
Much more than potential though, because Dwayne Bowe still is. He potentially will get back to where he was several years ago.
Sure.
And Brian Hartline potentially could be that threat that they've lacked since Gordon's been out.
And the same with Brian Hartline, because he was a deep threat in Miami until he kind of got phased out of that offense last year because they had brought in a new coordinator, and you know there was only room for one deep threat receiver in that offense, and that was Mike Wallace last year. So he kind of got phased out there, but he's had multiple 1,000-yard receiving seasons, so he's not done.
Yeah.
He's not old either.
Again, it's not the most.
Fear-inducing
receiving core in the league by any stretch.
No, it's serviceable. I think it's serviceable,
I think it has a potential to be pretty good. If all these ifs turn out to be yes, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But at the same time, it's still a big question mark.
Well, there's
but
still
not
the
big a question mark.
There's the quarterback position.
As that position.
And right now it looks like Josh McCown has the inside track to starting. He's been working pretty much exclusively with the first team offense and OTAs and minicamp. That's how head coach Mike Pettine said it was going to be, and it was. The question now is, is there going to be an actual competition come training camp? Is there going to be competition this summer? If Johnny Manziel goes out, because, Manziel has a history of being a better game player in-game than in practice, if he goes out and outplays McCown in the preseason, but maybe doesn't out-practice him all the time in training camp, then what? But for now, I'm just going to go with McCown as the starter until I hear otherwise, because that's basically what the Browns have been saying. That's what Mike Pettine has been saying. That's what Dwayne Bowe has been saying.
I agree completely.
McCown is stoked, by the way.
That's not the question to me.
McCown is stoked to be in Cleveland because he played. He got his butt destroyed last year in Tampa Bay behind that terrible offensive line, and he was so excited.
Yeah, he's got a good line
to be behind, in Cleveland and just work behind one of the best pass protecting, I think one of the top three pass protecting offensive lines from 2014. And they were pass protecting on three different quarterbacks and lost a center. So that's pretty impressive.
My question is not, it's not, will Josh McCown be the starter going into?
There's
no reason to not have Josh McCown the starter.
Sure.
For now.
Yeah.
And I think that.
Hold on to Johnny till he's ready. No one says you have to play a quarterback before he's ready.
Johnny, I mean, hey, potentially I'm wrong here, and he could be completely different now, and he, goes to camp, and it's another thing, and maybe he makes a lot of strides on the field, and he's gotten past a lot of his personal issues or whatnot, and maybe all that stuff is true. I feel like he's at least a year away from being ready to be a starter.
I agree with you there, just because John DeFilippo, I believe it was John DeFilippo, said that Manziel is doing things that he wasn't doing in college. Like, for example, he's throwing to his third read. Mm-hmm. And he was like, this is the first time in Manziel's career.
He didn't need a third read in college because he would just scramble around and Mike Evans would be open down the field and he'd heave it.
Exactly. So, DeFilippo was like, this is the first time in every single game I've ever watched all of Manziel's tape where he's getting to his third read. So if he's just learning how to hit a third read in July,
yeah,
give him another year. Or if something happens to McCown.
I thought he had a lot of football progress to make before he was going to even be remotely close to being to have a chance to be successful in the league.
Sure.
And then his first year was all this craziness with his partying and his
TMZ following him around.
We'll call it maturity issues. We'll call it
his lack of preparation once they finally called him up to start.
It was a complete and utter disaster.
He's called it a disaster.
Yeah, exactly. So. From many different respects.
He's called it a disaster,
to the point where he spent time in therapy for a couple months, right?
Not therapy. He spent time in rehab.
Yeah, in rehab for a couple months, and I'm sure he's still in therapy and trying to deal with a lot of his personal issues.
Absolutely. That's an ongoing process.
That's why this is a perfect example, or this is a perfect opportunity for him to just sit and continue to work on that part, continue to work on his head, while at the same time he's continuing to learn the game and get all the nuances
right.
down
that
the pro
game is. And
that's what
Pettine has been saying the whole time. But everybody's just like, but Johnny was a first-round pick. Johnny should be in the mix to start. And I will not deny that if Johnny Manziel is ready, he should be in a competition with McCown this summer.
Sure.
But if he's not ready, don't do it.
Don't do it. Because look
what happened last year.
Look what
happened last year. He was in a degree of competition more so than he is now, for sure, with Brian Hoyer. And the relationship between Manziel and Hoyer turned south. Mm-hmm. Hoyer didn't want to help out Manziel anymore because Manziel could steal his job.
Yeah,
so,
now McCown's a completely different guy. And
McCown's a completely different
act
guy.
Completely
and
differently
and
in
he's
that
willing
situation.
To be there to help. And if he doesn't start, he won't be bitter and he'll understand why. But it's a matter of Johnny being ready. And don't worry about it. You love Johnny Manziel. If you're a fan of Johnny Manziel,
you want him to wait until next year
you
before
want
he's
him
even
to
in the
not
conversation.
Not start until he's ready.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then
you don't need this kid to look more like a joke or something.
This gets me to my point about the big question, which is, it's not necessarily who's going to be the quarterback. I think it will be McCown. I don't doubt that. The question is one, how good is McCown going to be? Because frankly, he's got five good games.
That's true.
In my mind.
It's true.
He's been in the league for years and years and years. He's got five good games when he was forced into action for the Bears.
Yeah, he's played for like
under
seven
Trestman.
Or eight teams.
Yeah.
No, you don't do
it
that
was
if
one
you're
particular
like a
situation,
franchise quarterback.
One particular situation for five games on a different team under a different coach. It was just a whole, different situation. And I'm not saying that he won't be at least okay or decent or good. I don't know. I'm just saying I don't know. And that's why that's a question is how good is he in this situation? Then the other big question is what happens if he gets hurt? Because then you're dealing with you got Johnny sitting there.
Yeah, Connor
we've already
Shaw
talked
too.
About his situation. I know you're a huge Connor Shaw fan, and I'm not saying you shouldn't be. I'm just saying like that's a whole huge situation there. Because then everybody's going to be clamoring for if McCown goes down. Knock on wood. If McCown goes down, everybody in the world's going to say Johnny's going in. And
right.
You know this.
Right.
The ESPN will have it up. Johnny's going to be starting next week. I mean, it'll be the story for that week. And so there's going to be this pressure to put him in.
So
and
put that in that situation, you put in Shaw.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, if Connor Shaw is a better starter for you at the time, they should go with that. And then, but that's what I'm saying. Then that's, that it's just a whole, it's a big mess.
But the good news, there is a silver
lining.
Good news
is McCown's not hurt right now.
But there is a silver lining to all of it, regardless of who the quarterback is, and that is it's not going to be a quarterback-driven offense. It's going to be a run-game-driven offense.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a defense-driven team.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get that run game going again, if you can get that defense rushing the passer and stopping the run on top of having such an excellent secondary, less is going to be required out of the quarterback.
And I think
so that's what the Browns are primarily gunning for.
And that's why
point.
I'm actually kind of optimistic, even though I brought up all these issues, that's why I am kind of optimistic that if we said like the ifs with the receivers, Dwayne Bowe is stretching the field and everybody's filling their roles and McCown doesn't need to force it to those guys because it's kind of catching people off guard because you're expecting runs all the time or something like that. I could see that being effective,
sure.
Especially with a nice stout defense on the other side of the
field.
Yeah,
I
think this could be a pretty decent team.
The New York Jets with Mark Sanchez went to the AFC Championship game not because of Mark Sanchez,
no.
But because of the run game and the defense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from where
well,
Mike Patton
like,
comes.
And that's those
that's
early.
That's where Mike Patton comes from. That's
right.
that's his that's
yeah.
his core too.
That was the roadmap for the Ravens under young Flacco and
the Ravens with Dilfer
the
and
Bengals under young Dalton.
Yeah, and Roethlisberger's first Super
certainly,
Bowl
certainly,
and all
yeah.
of that. So anything is possible. But I'm optimistic. I'm just the front seven there just has to improve, and then everything else will kind of fall into place. I think
it's definitely.
But I don't know if they're going to get to seven wins though, just because the schedule is just so tough.
Yeah, that's the thing is it's I think it's an intriguing division. They had three playoff teams last year. I think that's probably going to be tough to replicate because of the
yes.
schedule situation.
Yes, I agree.
Plus,
I
each of these teams
that, yeah.
have some weird things
there's
that they're going to have to. Yeah, we'll have to see. It'll take a few weeks to see. It might even take half the season to kind of get a feel for where they're going to go or what they are.
Especially,
really.
Yeah, to understand what is this Steelers defense? What is this Ravens offense? What is this Bengals pass rush? Who is this Bengals quarterback?
Right, right.
What is going on in Cleveland at all? You know what I mean? So it might take us a good 6 to 8 weeks into the regular season before we can really even kind of get an identity, for these four teams.
But hey, that sounds like fun
at this
point.
Sounds like
to be six
fun.
Weeks into the season and like figuring out who these teams are.
I'm all for it. Well, we're gonna take a quick break here at the F-Ball NFL podcast. Then we're gonna wrap things up and take it on home. So stay tuned. There's not much left. Don't worry. Tear it down. Tear it down. Tear it down. And we're back here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast for just a few moments just to say goodbye.
Absolutely.
Hope you enjoyed, everybody who listened, enjoyed this episode. We're now on Stitcher. So if you use the Stitcher app for your podcast listening pleasure, you can now find us. You just search the F-Ball NFL Podcast, and we'll be there. You can listen to us whenever you want.
We're trying to make it easier to get inside your brains.
Easier to get inside your brains. We'll be back next week, of course, doing some more divisional preview action and, of course, recapping any news that may come down around the NFL over the next 7 days. Until that time, I'm Andrea Hengst. I cover the AFC North, cover the Browns and the Steelers for BleacherReport.com, cover the Cleveland Browns for Scout.com, and I cover the entire National Football League for SportsOnEarth.com. So check me out at any and all of those sites. Or if you want all of my articles in one convenient location, you can head over to Facebook. Go to facebook.com/AHangstNFL, AHANGSTNFL. And you can get everything all in one convenient locale. And you can also find me, of course, on Twitter at FBall_Andrea. That's FBALL_Andrea.
And, of course, I'm Brian. I'm on this podcast.
Of course you are.
Because you're hearing me right now. And otherwise, I'm on Twitter at BFAT65. That's at BFAT65.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the F-Ball NFL Podcast. And we will be back next week. Until then, enjoy your summer. Enjoy these last lazy days before training camp begins. And thus, a new cycle of NFL insanity. Until then, we'll catch you on the flippity floppity.
Something like that.
Peace.
Later.
I'm not kosher, bro. Unapproachable. A spokesman, I give a fuck, so go. I